You can give me a prescription for booze. Is that that's what you're saying?
Well, it sounds like, you know, prescriptions are best when they're specific. For you, it would have to be bourbon or whiskey, I'm gathering from the previous conversation.
This is my doc right here.
I'm not sure what will be edited or quoted.
You know, Jordan has turned this podcast into a thing where he gets like free advice from people that he would normally have to pay for. It's just really, it's a sad thing. But look, he says he's rich and I don't believe it. All right. You know, doctor, here's the thing.
Doctor, can you finish just that? If there are more active ways,
You know, if you guys pay taxes, you're paying my salary. I'm NIH funded. I'm happy to give advice. It's not for free. It's what I do and love.
Okay, Jordan. So here's what I want to bring up, because we were getting ready to start this, I ran into a discussion you were having with some of your colleagues about Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
So my wife and I and one of my daughters, we were watching the Elvis movie that's now available streaming. I didn't know that. And I had a thing that popped up in my head that I'd like to know what you think. You know, we'd always heard that Colonel Parker was a horrible guy. You know, I mean, if you say Colonel Parker, we say bad, right? Elvis, we say good. And
in my circles, we have a little bit more of a conversation about things. We don't like grunt like cavemen when somebody poses a question, but I understand where you're coming from.
Okay. Well, I try to make it simple. You
Elvis,
know,
keep good. Parker, bad.
Yeah.
Music.
So
good.
here's
pay
here's
for
the question.
Music. Bad. Oh, these are artists. They pour their heart into things. You should be contemplating the ideas around them, not just giving them a thumbs up, thumbs down. Like,
all right,
Joaquin
can I get
Phoenix
to the question? Maybe you don't want
to
answer.
No, it's a podcast. You have to listen to people. Let me get to the end of it and then thumbs up, thumbs down me like Joaquin Phoenix.
Okay, I'll let you ramble on. Go ahead. Just like the song.
I finished. That was
okay.
Now
let me
ramble.
Ask you the question.
Get ready.
So, Colonel Parker, in watching that movie, it made me wonder whether Colonel Parker had been, would Elvis have been who Elvis was without Colonel Parker? Seriously.
Wait, you watched that Elvis movie and you were like sympathetic more towards Colonel Parker?
No, I haven't finished the movie. I'm just about halfway or three quarters through. But look, there are so many talented people out there, singers who you hear them and you say, well, why isn't that person famous? You know, to some degree, it's because they didn't have the right promoter. And if there was anything that Colonel Parker was, it was a promoter. I mean, he was basic. So the question is, and I know Elvis was led down a bad stretch, and you know, ultimately with doctors and everything else, he dies. But what role did Colonel Parker have? It's sort of like Brian Epstein with the Beatles. You know, they said that once they lost him, they kind of lost their way. I don't know if that's true or false, but it's an argument. So the question is, how much did Colonel Parker have to do with Elvis being able to literally break out and become, you know, this unbelievable mega celebrity?
Now, I will say this. I am not an Elvis expert. I watched the movie last night as well. I've watched a few documentaries because I was down in Memphis recently at Sun Studios, kind of got into that Elvis vibe. So
what were you doing down there, by the way?
I was recording a piece for The Daily Show, and I swung by Sun Studios, and they were incredibly kind. They were Daily Show fans, and not to brag, and we maybe even talked about this before.
Oh, go ahead. Brag a little bit,
Jordan.
Let
me brag.
Because whatever I do, you just really put me down. But go ahead.
As somebody who's the king of satirical comedy, I was like, hey, you guys are cool. This is an amazing place to be. Is it possible if after our shoot, if we came back with a bottle of whiskey and you let us hang out in the studio where Elvis was found and Johnny Cash recorded and the Million Dollar Quartet hung out? And they were like, yeah, totally. And I don't want to get anybody fired because they were wonderful people. But we all hung out right there in that amazing studio, drank a little whiskey, talked about Elvis, talked about Johnny Cash, talked about the music of that time.
I met Johnny Cash, by the way. I met Johnny Cash.
Oh, I bet he loved you.
He did. I met Johnny Cash and I met his wife in D.C., the group of us that went to the small little theater where he was performing. Tell me that's not really cool. But anyway, back to the whiskey.
What did he say? What did Johnny Cash say to you?
What did he say to me?
Yes.
Here's what he said. Hello, I'm Johnny Cash. Now, thanks for inviting me. thanks for inviting me to the studio. You invite me to a boxing match, you know? How about inviting me to the Sun studio? Come on down.
You want an invitation? You want me after the Daily Show to say, you know what, before we have this wonderful situation, let me call Governor Kasich from state of Ohio to come on down. He loves music. He loves it so much that he weighs in with one word when somebody poses a question as to the benefit.
Go back to my initial question. So what do you think about that whole business of Colonel Parker and promoters and all that?
I mean, I think, you know what? I think it's a dirty business, and I think, especially at that time, so many musicians got taken advantage of because there was no clear path to success. I think the story of Elvis, he was an incredibly talented guy. I think at a time where, by their own account, the stories of Sam Phillips, my understanding, you know what, this was a music that was catching hold, and having an attractive white man who could sell it was something that was an easy sell. And it's what they got glossed over in the film that I was told down at Sun Studios. Elvis walks in there, a late teenager, records a song. Sam Phillips is out of town, and they sit on it for like 8 months because the secretary at the time, who took a larger role in Sun Studios, she loved him. She saw something there. Sam Phillips didn't see something there. And it wasn't until later that they brought him back in, and he, through some improv in a studio session with some studio musicians, kind of brought up his influences, that something really popped. Then my understanding was that then they literally take that record down to the local DJ, who plays it like 12 times in 2 hours, and it becomes sort of this local hit. And so you need somebody, obviously, you need an infrastructure to get this out in front of more people.
Yeah, but I think
I think more often than not, the managers aren't crafting what people are responding to. They're just creating the pomp and circumstance around it. And I think I watched that Elvis story, and I see him destroying what was an interesting creative talent and making him like just a consumer object in a way that was was really
well,
sad.
I haven't finished it. I'm looking forward to it.
Well,
but when when we talk about ripoffs, look, you think about Bohemian Rhapsody and what Freddie Mercury had to do. A lot of it is luck. Luck is a part of life. We should ask the doctor about how we should think about luck. And some people have it and some people don't. He went and he got this obscure DJ to play the Bohemian Rhapsody because they said the thing was too long. And we know what's happened today. Then you think about more modern day Kesha. Kesha had a lot of problems being able to break away from. She said that she was being controlled, I think, by her manager. That Taylor Swift got in this big fight over, you know, who had the rights to her stuff. There are a lot of people today in any business that get taken advantage of, whether they're NFL stars or basketball stars or it's why you got to have good people around you. And clearly with Colonel Parker, he was out to take advantage ultimately of Elvis, but got to have good people around you. So.
You do. And there's a lot of vultures out there who see a potential to make a buck and they jump on it. It's hard to break into that music industry. And, I think what's actually fascinating about right now is there are different gatekeepers and you can get music and sounds out there. Now, the promotion side and, you know, knowing somebody with a checkbook or a Rolodex is still part of the game. But
well, let me ask you this. When you think about the Elvis thing, what I was taken by was when he was a kid and where they lived and his youth experiences that really shaped him. So you being in the comedy world and coming from Kalamazoo, was that part of what you witnessed when you were a kid, or this whole be able to get on a stage and talk? I mean, does the apple ever fall far from the tree? It's another good question for this doctor.
Yeah.
How about you?
Well, I mean, personally, I do think, you know, you are a product of your influences in many ways. I think I had I fell in love with the world of entertainment and certain comedians initially. You fall in love with Ghostbusters. Then I went through a huge Jim Carrey phase, and it wasn't until sort of college when I was influenced by sketch comedy and Monty Python, a lot of British comedy, in a way that, you know, I was at that point interested in exploring that world. And I think the influences and the things that make you laugh, not only are they things that you are attempting to emulate or compare yourself to, it's also the thing that draws you to your collaborators. And I think, you know, that's something that you start to see. Like taste draws you to other people with interesting taste. If you look at Bob Dylan, something that's always stood out to me, I'm a big Bob Dylan fan. At the time, it was hard to come by old blues albums. So like the albums of Robert Johnson, Dylan was growing up in Minnesota. You have to know friends who know friends, and the cool kid in town has that one Robert Johnson album, and he hangs out with the other cool kids in town who feel like outsiders, and they're into weird blues music, and so they become friends. And you see these interesting pockets pop up, especially around a time when you didn't have access to these influences. You see pockets pop up of people who actually knew each other growing up because they felt like outcasts who were seeking out, whether it was record stores or the cool kid in town, who were seeking out other people who were also seekers looking for these influences. And so that starts to create a scene. Shared taste kind of creates influences. It creates competition. And then you add a little bit of opportunity and some ambition to it, and you got yourself a movement.
Well, listen, we've got a very distinguished guy as a guest today, and he's got patience and everything. I did want to get into
that is a good
listen,
joke.
I wanted to get into patience. Yeah, both ways. Yeah, that's what I say about, you know what, you know, if I tell people who are nursing school, if you're a good nurse, you know what you need? Patience. And they're like, yeah, you have to really be calm. I said, no. But anyway, why don't we go ahead and try to bring this gentleman on.
That's right. We're just going to talk Elvis for the next hour. Get ready, folks. I'm very excited about our guest today. I read some articles and he has a fascinating book that kind of shifted the way I think about stuff. He's a neuroscientist and the director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at Columbia University. And he's known for his work in Alzheimer's disease and cognitive aging. His book, Forgetting: The Benefits of Not Remembering, focuses on the beneficial aspects of memory loss. So we're excited to have Dr. Scott Small join us today. Doctor, how are you?
I'm doing well. Please call me Scott.
Scott, how soon can I forget the hot takes the governor has about music? Is there any way you can expedite that process as a doctor?
Yeah, there are ways. And it's actually an interesting question because, as you say, I am a neurologist who could be boiled down to being considered a brain mechanic. Mechanically, I've been trying to think of the levers to pull to cure pathological forgetting, Alzheimer's and aging. But as I've covered the book tour on the benefits of normal forgetting, and maybe we get into that, what's the distinction? More and more people have been asking me the doctor's question. Well, okay, I'm convinced normal forgetting might be beneficial. How could I, what levers can I pull to expedite that? And there actually are ways, but of course in the brain, it's never simple.
Well, let's explore that a little bit right now. So for our audience, you hear forgetting, and I think culturally we see forgetting as a deficiency. It's something that at all costs we're trying to escape from. But what you argue within this book are the benefits of forgetting. Can you kind of lay that out for us?
Yeah, and that's you're absolutely right. So, I mean, I started my career. Interesting hearing how you started your career, by the way. The one interview I'm sorry I said no to back in the day was to Jon Stewart. We can talk about that offline. But
something you clearly did not forget. That has stuck with you.
Because I am generally sorry, and I thought I did it for the right reasons. I turned out to be righteous. One should never be righteous. But I entered my career. I think most people enter their career, whether they're memory doctors or memory scientists, with a singular view that all forgetting is the same, whether it's the forgetting that my patients I saw this morning suffer from, or the forgetting that we're all born with. It's all the same. It's the rusting of the memory mechanisms in the brain. And the book was inspired by new science. I wouldn't just write a feel-good book. It's not my bailiwick. It's not my temperament. But it's based on the new science that emerged in the last 10 years that actually the brain is endowed with specific mechanisms in our neurons, in our brain, to accelerate forgetting. Normal forgetting, the forgetting we're all born with, we all have, we all complain about, that is categorically different than the pathological forgetting that my patients experience.
Doctor, first of all, let's just talk about the brain for a second. I've always sort of felt, you know, I know we're going to go back to the moon, we're going to get to Mars, everybody's excited about that, and I mean, we should be excited about it. But I sort of feel that the next frontier is the discovery of the brain. How little do we know? How much more is there to be uncovered by people in your field? And what can it mean for things like drug addiction, obesity, a whole variety of things, right? I mean, the brain, if it gets unlocked, it can yield so many things to help our society. Or tell me where you think we are. How far along are we?
Well, first of all, John, I agree with you. I've committed my career because of the fascination in the brain, and because I think it's generally acknowledged as true that it is the last frontier, at least in the body, in science. And it expands from not only unlocking ways to cure disease, and that's the ones, but also Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, the ones that I
right.
But it's also important for society, consciousness, why we sleep, why we forget. So all those questions, I like the way you phrase it, have to be unlocked. They're being unlocked. They're being unlocked slowly and in different ways. I can talk a little bit about how there is now a cautious optimism that we're finally unlocking the mysteries of things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So that's something that I can speak with authority about, less so consciousness.
Well, how far along are we in that? There's so many families, I mean, you know, so many families in this country that are suffering, seeing their loved ones begin to develop this disease. How far along are we in terms of being able to come up with an answer? I mean, that's like, you know, the million-dollar question, right?
Yeah, it's a super important one. Obviously, we all know people, not only the patients I see, we all have family and friends who suffer from these disorders. I will say, John, you know, I'll use a politician's phrase that I refrain from using. These are Soviet politicians who always had the five-year promise, right?
And yeah.
Somehow doctors borrowed that. We always said within 5 years, there's something about 5 years that's far in the future. But what I can say, the reason why I myself have shifted from abject pessimism just 10 years ago to cautious optimism is because of the way we think of the brain. So I already invoked the mechanics logic, just like any car mechanic. You're never going to fix a broken car unless you know what's fundamentally broken. And in the brain, it's true. In biomedicine, it's a sort of truism cliche. And so only recently, Tom, can we begin to say that we know what's fundamentally broken in Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease? Not 10 years ago, not 20 years ago. There's been attempts, and there's been honest attempts and vigorous attempts. But only in the last 10 years has the field as a whole felt that we know the fundamental parts in our brains, in our neurons that are broken. Once we have that locked down, let me remind you one of the really interesting lessons from COVID. Once you know the pathogen, once you know what causes a disease, the biomedical enterprise, which includes industry and academia, can find a cure pretty rapidly. So that's why I'm cautiously optimistic.
I want to actually talk a little bit about COVID. We went through this pandemic, this trauma. You actually wrote an op-ed for the New York Times. We will forget much of the pandemic, and that's a good thing. Talk to me a little bit about that. We had this cultural trauma that we are dealing with. How much should we be learning from that? And how much is it better for us as a society to have this natural shedding of memories? And where are we on that path?
Yeah, and that's a good way to kind of segue perhaps into normal forgetting. And for those who read the article, it wasn't that we should forget anything. God forbid, I emphasize, and I suffered here in New York personally and as a doctor with the true suffering that we should never forget, the loss of friends, family, the lessons we should learn, whether it's public policy or medical lessons, so we don't repeat the mistakes. Those are clearly things that should be etched in our collective memory and our personal memories. But the point of the book, actually, Jordan, is that there needs to be a balance between memory and forgetting. And so I borrow from the lessons learned in PTSD, a common affliction, sadly. And PTSD is in many ways, one should be careful of simplifying any disorder, but in many ways, it's the canonical go-to example of a disorder in where the normal forgetting mechanisms have broken down. Alzheimer's is an example where the memory mechanisms have broken down, but PTSD, particularly in the emotional memory realm, that's where combatant soldiers, anyone who suffered a traumatic experience can't let go, right, of the negative memories. Letting go is one of the many colloquialisms we use in our common language that actually refers to forgetting. Let go of something means to forget. So we all intuitively know that. We know anyone who's been married knows that you need to let go sometimes. Letting go, that forgetting is critically important. And in the article, I talk about how in order to really remember the important stuff, we need to better let go and forget the emotionally charged stuff. Otherwise, we're in sort of total recall day in, day out on the sort of emotional stuff. And that will really prevent us remembering important stuff.
I guess when we talk about that theoretically, are there active choices? Like if somebody reads that article and agrees with it, when I think of letting go or forgetting, it does feel like a passive action. Especially forgetting does in my mind. Are there active ways to do it? I mean, I'm not asking for a prescription for booze, although I would take it. That would be maybe my first path. But can somebody be proactive about forgetting, or are we still just talking about a natural process?
Well, like I said at the get-go, even if it's a natural process, if it's broken, I am perfectly within my rights as a doctor to try to fix it. So if people are
you can give me a prescription for booze. Is that that's what you're saying?
Well, it sounds like, you know, prescriptions are best when they're specific. For you, it would have to be bourbon or whiskey, I'm gathering from the previous conversation.
This is my doc right here.
I'm not sure what will be edited or quoted.
You know, Jordan has turned this podcast into a thing where he gets like free advice from people that he would normally have to pay for. It's just really, it's a sad thing. But look, he says he's rich and I don't believe it. All right. You know, doctor, here's the thing.
Doctor, can you finish just that? If there are more active ways.
You know, if you guys pay taxes, you're paying my salary. I'm NIH funded. I'm happy to give advice. It's not for free. It's what I do and love. So here's the answer, Jordan. There are a lot of ways in which we can now accelerate the normal forgetting.
There you go.
Actually, the most important thing is sleep. And maybe we get to that if we have time. Sleep, the thing we do, you know, a third of our lives exposes us to the dangers of the environment. Why do we do it? We can answer a high school student. Why do we eat? Why do we drink? Why do we rest? But why do we sleep? One of the answers is it because it induces smart forgetting. It allows us to forget and clear the slate. Otherwise, our brains are sort of bonkers with too much information. Medically, there are ways. And if I use PTSD as an example, so you might know that there are clinical trials now on drugs that have conventionally been considered recreational, MDMA, ecstasy, LSD. These are drugs that have shown, particularly ecstasy, MDMA, has shown the mechanism is known. It particularly, what it does among its many things, is it induces the brain areas that store emotional memories to relax and forget. And if no one on this call has ever taken ecstasy, I am sure. But if you want to know what the benefits of forgetting is, speak to anyone who has. The testimonials are you feel pro-social, you love people more. Love, that word is invoked. And that's, I think, an interesting testimonial on how a brain that's bogged down with too many emotional memories, it lives in misery. So emotional forgetting is there. You can manipulate it with natural endeavors like sleep, and there are some clinical trials that are tapping into the new science of forgetting.
Well, you know, doctor, the PTSD, people, you know, hear about it for our soldiers, but they don't understand how many of our service people are trapped in this and how tragic it is. And it needs to, again, be something that we have to put the spotlight on, because it's terrible.
We'll be right back. And now back to the show.
Look, there's two other areas. You were talking about, talk about accelerating discovery. Do we put enough money? Does NIH put enough money? And you're an NIH-funded guy, you may not want to say. I've never felt as though we put enough money into this brain research. Secondly, I'd like to know what your thoughts are on deep brain stimulation. I have a friend down at WVU who works at the Rockefeller Institute, and he's been involved in deep brain stimulation. And he was able, with some Alzheimer's patients, to basically return them pretty much to normal, which was shocking when I first learned of it. I actually had him in my cabinet room to talk about this. He believes that, and it's more sophisticated than just deep brain stimulation, it can affect Alzheimer's as well, including things like addiction, all using the brain. give me a sense of what that could mean.
So first on funding,
and his name is Ali Rezai. He's a great guy. He was at Cleveland Clinic, then he went to Ohio State. Now he's at the Rockefeller Center at WVU, working with Gordon Gee and Clay Marsh. And I love this guy. He's got so many things he thinks about, and he never stops working because he's so excited about the breakthroughs that he thinks that he can be part of.
Yep, same. That's same. That would describe my life. And my wife, if she was on, she would complain about my 18-hour days. But we love it. So it's not workaholism. It's fun and important. But on NIH funding, yes, I am funded. The Alzheimer's Disease Research Center is funded by the NIH, NIA. There has been the sense that maybe there needs to be more funding for this critically important field. That has happened, John. I'm not sure if you were part of that effort. But yes, there has been a lot more money. So the National Institute of Aging, which is the division of the NIH that's focused on Alzheimer's, has received a lot more funding just in the last few years. So there has been a political awareness. Now, we can debate about whether it's enough. Does it meet the same level that cancer received in the 1970s and 80s? Obviously, we can always use more. But I don't like to complain. And I'm I think many of us are. There clearly could be more a more concerted effort. On deep brain stimulation, absolutely fascinating. I love that field. I send particularly, I think you might have meant Parkinson's. And Parkinson's, it's now the standard of care. If drugs don't work,
yeah,
now understand, you talked about unlocking the brain. The brain is a circuit, is a network. It's complicated, right? It's not just, not to be dismissive of my cardiology colleagues. It's not just pumps and valve. I'm sure I'll hear back from them. But it's a complicated network, a circuit, an electrical organ. And the unlocking there required basic science to understand exactly where to place these electrodes. I can imagine you can still hear me. I just saw some shifting. Yes?
Yeah. No, listen. Okay. Yeah, doctor. And what I want to do, because if you do have an interest in, is to get you information and have you be able to talk to Dr. Rezai. Because his whole process has become more and more sophisticated from where it was. And I think he's getting pretty good results.
Too. Yeah. So deep brain stimulation, the way anyone should see this is that we should be humble in the face of the task at hand. Every approach should be legitimate and should be investigated using scientific rigor. Deep brain stimulation, certainly for Parkinson's disease, maybe for normal cognitive aging. I know I have colleagues who are doing this from Alzheimer's. The data is not clear to me yet, but we're all open-minded. No one should have their pet project take precedence over anyone, particularly when you have to look the patient in the eye. It's all about the patient, not about.
Right.
I'm curious. Now, in your book, you talk a little bit about when we look at normal forgetting. You talk about that as a creative endeavor, and you even connect creatives as being exceptional at forgetting. I'm curious what that means. Does it mean you have to, or that an active mind that is uncluttering leaves itself open for more inspiration? Like how is this something? I mean, I'm asking for a friend myself.
Yeah.
How do I find inspiration through the process of forgetting? And how necessary is that in a creative mind?
For yourself as an artist, for my wife as an artist, and frankly, I think good science is artistic. And so it all relates. And in fact, in the book, I had the pleasure of interviewing and talking with Jasper Johns, you know, arguably the greatest artist, living artist in the United States. And it's something that's always been interesting to me. And the testimonials of the genius artists, scientists, mathematicians has always led to the following conclusion, which gets to the heart of the book, that it's not just memory. Yes, you need to wash your mind with visuals, with music, with whatever with data, if you're a scientist. But if that information becomes too concrete in your mind, you never have that inspirational eureka moment of the unexpected connections. And so the testimonials, time and time again, point to the requirement of having memory on the one hand, we talked about that, but also having forgetting on the other to keep those memories loose and playful in our minds. so that that eureka moment is more likely to happen. That's where forgetting plays a role.
I'm actually curious if we expand that a little bit. You're kind of talking about a plastic or an elastic mind that is both able to let go and able to remember. The governor and I were in this political world and we're constantly talking about the space that we are in. I wonder, when you look at that, it feels like I have frustration with what I see, both people unable to learn from the past. I know learning is different than just normal forgetting, but also it does feel like there are people who also cling to certain things and ideas in a way that aren't leaving them open to discover a moment that we're in or a place that we're in. How do you look at the political landscape from your perspective and see forgetting taking a role?
I mean, as you guys already discovered, I would take a pass if it's not relevant to my interests or my book, but it happens to be. So I try to illustrate the benefits of the balance of memory and forgetting through new insight from psychology, neurology, computer science. But the last chapter is on the philosophy of the benefit of forgetting, and it very much deals with the issue of xenophobia. So it was really a unique pleasure of mine to read Johannes Hofer's thesis, 1688, who wrote On Nostalgia. That's where nostalgia was born.
It's great. We all love that. That's a favorite for all of us. The governor and I talk about that thesis almost every podcast.
I'm wearing my white coat. I could be a little bit recondite, but you should read it, and or read the chapter, because I break it down. He's basically describing nostalgia as a disorder of the mind that is too obsessed with our personal backgrounds. He quotes, "We can't let go of mother's milk. We can't forget mother's milk." It is a great paper to read, and maybe broken down in the book, on how it relates to today's environment, whether it's extreme xenophobia or tribalism or the political polarization that I know Governor Kasich cares very much about. It's all related to a certain extent. And so in that chapter, the previous chapters were how the balance of memory and forgetting are needed for our own personal minds. There's also something called collective memory, right? And let's not forget that society has forgiven and forgotten. Think of South Africa. It's a process. But I think we need to engage the collective memory forgetting balance to really heal what I feel is a suffering nation.
Dr. Jordan said something. I've been thinking about it in the last podcast. He was making a comment that it's hard for people, because of the social media structure, for people who have, and I don't mean boring, but a kind of a middle approach, a more peacemaker approach. What do you think it is? And I find that to be a really interesting comment, that we can't get out of our own way because we're sort of stuck here. What is it about the brain that forces us to look at extremes? You know, you go to a boxing match, you want to see a knockdown. You go to a car race, you want to see a crash. I mean, that's what you hear all the time. Is there a way to overcome that? Is there a way to make peacemaking more exciting? Or is our brain wired in such a way that we leap to those things that exist on the extremes?
Well, obviously the brain is hardwired for the flashbulb memory, you know, whether it was Kennedy for you and I, John, or 9/11 for our younger colleague here, Jordan. We all remember those things. And so that just gets to the point, the brain encodes, you know, flashbulbs. But what I think is most important in trying to engage forgetting for the societal balance, I do think that we're off kilter. I think we're all obsessed with our own personal collective memories. And one way, you were asking, Jordan, how to kindle the natural rebalancing to bring forgetting back in, is something, John, I know you know. You just maybe not have thought of it in terms of memory and forgetting. And that's just socializing, right? The political effort, the ambassador effort, the peacemaking meetings, these have proven in science, when two people sit down, two people who might hate each other, sit down, look into each other's eyes, you immediately, and there's actually science behind that. Not everything needs to be explained neurologically, but there's actual mechanisms for why, if two people dislike each other, entrenched in their views. You sit them down in the same room, they relax because it causes the emotional memory areas of the brain to relax, to forget. And that has been shown time and time again, as you probably know very well, you know, World War II and racism. It was a real step forward because people from different colors had to fight together and live together. And so, you know, the examples better than I can only provide the neurobiology of why socializing is so very important. One of the problems, and I might be a little long-winded here. One of the problems with COVID, Jordan, you were asking about it. I touch on it in my New York Times piece, is that there was a double whammy during the pandemic. COVID was a trauma for many, clearly. If socializing is a way to prevent our memories from burning too hot, that is actually, John, part of the standards of care for PTSD. Don't have these poor soldiers live in isolation. So we need to socialize to engage our emotional forgetting. This has been the problem with COVID. We were forced to socially isolate. And there's this real expectation that my psychology colleagues are going to see a very specific form of PTSD that is related to the pandemic. So the simple answer, John, is try to keep the socializing, your effort of keeping both sides of the aisle, communicating, sitting down, eating together, having whiskey together.
Well, I want to expand on this because I do think this is interesting. The governor, what we were talking about recently is this idea that the platforms for us to have in-depth conversations in and of themselves are not beneficial to moderate points of view for nuance. They lean towards hyperbole, and so that these platforms dictate a really dangerous type of communication. And so, from your perspective, neurologically, I'm curious: one, how does social media affect memory and forgetting? And two, I'm guessing it doesn't have a great effect on the brain. But two, I'm wondering if you zoom out on that. Technologically speaking, if we had a technological advance in media, television, social media, the internet, that has in any way been beneficial to that process, or is inherently any kind of technological advancement that we've had in media communication working against what is going on up top?
Yeah. So first, let me just bring this back to neurobiology again. Always dangerous to simplify, but there is a neurobiological mechanism where if we meet each other in person, that it relaxes our biases, relaxes our fears, and it's called oxytocin. You might have heard of this. It's sometimes called the love hormone, which is wrong, but there is hard science in our top journals that have shown that just eye-to-eye gazing will cause each of us to secrete oxytocin, to emotionally forget, and to become pro-social, to become less hyperbolic, as you're describing, Jordan. In fact, I'm not sure if there are any animal lovers on the call. The same is true for dogs. That was a Science Journal article that was fantastic. So there is neurobiology for why socializing is so important. It, of course, does other things. Here's the interesting question, Jordan. We're Zooming now. We're looking into each other's eyes. I'm willing to bet, I don't know if that study has done, that our brains know better. Our brains are not now secreting oxytocin, if that is the proxy for pro-social benefits. And therefore, I would say, let's try to get back in the same room. Let's have real 3D meetings to engage our brains' forgetting mechanisms.
Do you think, though, if we look at social media as a mechanism, beyond it being something that's done solo and not you're talking to people, but not having that connection, functionally, it does feel like there is a glut of information that you're receiving. And if part of the process of memory and forgetting is sort of weeding through the things that you don't need to survive, but now we're being flooded with information in a way that we never have before. Are you seeing ways in which that is structurally changing our brain?
I haven't. I'm sure the studies, if not done already, will be done because it's a clear societal question. Two quick points. Clearly, the flood of information is never good on why we need to sleep to unclutter our minds. And so if that's adding to the clutter, and it's typically not necessarily curated information, right? And then on the other issue that to me seems to ring more true is that people are doing this in isolation. So if someone really had something to say, I'd prefer to hear them say it in a conference meeting or at a bar. And of course, social media doesn't accommodate that.
Well, the problem we have, Doctor, is that people, we have like, you know, hundreds of millions of people. We can't just get them all in the same room. And in fact, when you take a look at some of these polls, and I always have a look at any poll with a grain of salt, you know, I'm going to move to where the people who think the way I do, you know, live. I don't want my kids marrying somebody of the other political persuasion. I mean, we don't have an opportunity with the current media to have people actually be in the same room. And so they get fed this extremism, you know, and that fires them up. And then there's an inability of people to be connected. Now, I also happen to think, though, that intuitively, that people want peace. They don't want to be in a constant state of fighting. People do want to feel comfortable and relaxed and, you know, and really connected to somebody else once you get through the early stage. I guess that's kind of what you're talking about in terms of meetings. That's what melts it down, right?
Well, could I just offer, you know, I way out of my bailiwick and recommendation, I wonder what you think about this, Governor. I have a feeling you have strong feelings. The best way to instantiate that social networking, that true social connection, now that we don't all go to the military, now that we don't all go to the peace service, is to have a few years of a national effort to do something. I really think that that will, on the neurobiology, will establish the networks, the true connections. And of course, I think it's also important for us as Americans to feel like we're unified. I have a feeling you have strong feelings about that.
Well, I was working for a short time with the National Veterans Museum here in Columbus, Ohio, and trying to figure out ways to actually make it more relevant. And one of them is to offer our soldiers a concierge service to help them get jobs and, you know, embrace the family, which would help in many different ways. But the other one was the issue of volunteerism. I don't know if you're not at this point in time be able to pass something that forces it. But if you could create incentives for it, I think I absolutely think that this is an issue that time has not yet come, but might come, because you're just really saying you're putting people together who didn't know one another or didn't even like one another all of a sudden to find out that they do. That was the value of playing basketball in the gym when I was in Congress, the value of having dinners and
national, as some form of national service seems right. Yeah. Of course, it's complicated. You can't force it. But if you make it attractive, I can't tell you how many emails I get from impassioned 13-year-olds. Dear Dr. Small, I'm obsessed with Alzheimer's. I want to work in your lab. And they don't. It's their helicopter parents who are saying, look, we want you to go to a great school. Try to get a gig with Dr. Small. I think psychologically, so I grew up in Israel. I think psychologically, having that break from the assembly line of high school to college, and I know it's hard to do, but I encourage that with all my friends and family. Have your kid, instead of spending $100,000 in a party school, have him travel the world, have him engage in others, and I'll leave it up to you politicians to implement that.
It's interesting. I did an interview with Sebastian Younger, who's a war correspondent, and spent so much time. He wrote a book called Tribe that looked at sort of the way in which we think. And in asking him this question, he had the same answer about the year of public service and a way in which to look at it, which I do think is under-discussed in conversations here, which is a real bummer. I mean, I would never do it. I would never just give a year away like that. My public service was on the improv stages. I worked for free to give people the gift of comedy. So maybe in some ways I did it.
But you did. And my wife also, she worked in Atlantic City as a singer when everyone was off to college. But if you make it not a public service.
They say if you could make it there, you could make it anywhere. I've heard that said.
I'll let her know that. But I think it could be done in a way that it seems appealing, you know, not as a sort of like a burden, as
right.
a burden.
We'll be right back. And now back to the show.
Doctor, I want, since you're both a researcher and also you're someone that spends time with patients, how does somebody in your field, whether they're a trained social worker, whether they're a psychologist, whether they're a psychiatrist, how do you avoid burnout? How can you go the long distance? Because your profession is so tough. Calls coming day and night, and you know, people are helpless and panicked. And what is the best advice you have for people who want to enter this field without experiencing a significant burnout in a short period of time?
It's a really interesting question, John. I'm enjoying this more than usual, just because, you know, the free-flowing conversation, but also because of the unexpected question. That certainly is one of them. I do think, John, you were talking about nurses. I do think one has to realize, no matter where you are as a healthcare provider, it's a team. And maybe it comes back to the socialization the socializing we were talking about earlier. The people who don't burn out are the people who really work as part of a center or a group. And there is no hierarchy between the MD, the nurse practitioner, the social worker. We're all in this together. Those are the people, I think, who just feel that they are part of an important effort. Clearly they are. It's the doctors who work in solo that I sometimes see faster burnout in. Now, again, I'm not an expert on this. There are a lot of public health scientists who think about this, but that's my view, John.
Forgive me if this is a stretch, but sort of inspired off of that idea, I'm curious. You have looked and you've talked about the new research that you wrote your book about, which is sort of shedding light on this idea that perhaps we don't focus enough on the natural ability to forget the information that we learn. Perhaps there's been too much effort put into the memory portion, or at least thought put into that. And I wonder, as a doctor who's gone through rigorous years of training, looking at education in general, did it color your view of the way in which you were taught and the rigors of memorization and the things that were given certain import, as you've discovered perhaps an uncluttered mind leads to a better life, or perhaps a moments of inspiration? Do you see did you see your schooling in any different light?
Actually, interesting. I hate to be the guy who keeps on referring back to his book, but I guess that's what got us together.
You got to do it. It's a great book. It's called Forgetting. And here's the problem. Embedded in it is the idea that people listening to this right now, they may just let it go, and that's okay. Have to keep hitting it.
But there is a chapter, every chapter I try to have someone who can guide me through complex questions. There, I was lucky to know Danny Kahneman, the Nobel Prize winner on decision making. And I shared with him a patient of mine. This was a fellow doctor who was an infectious disease expert. He came to me, he said, "I think I have bad memory. How could I be a good doctor?" And so what that led us into, and we tested his memory, and his memory was really bad, not pathological, but sort of on the short end of the stick, right, on the normal distribution. And yet he succeeded, and he's a world-class physician. I call him Dr. X because I can't say anything more about him. But what that led into is this idea of intellectual humility. It's a term. It sounds like a sort of compliment, and it's not meant as a compliment. It's meant that people who have really outstanding memories tend to jump the gun. And Danny Kahneman writes about people who make quick decisions and often get it wrong. Now, of course, if you're a Air Force pilot, if you're an ER doc, you need to make quick decisions. But a diagnostician like me, I have the benefit of 2 days before I can cogitate, think, and revise. The ability to change your mind requires forgetting. And that doctor, I think, turned out to be an exceptional diagnostician because he actually had good, normal forgetting. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but I think it's relevant.
Honestly, but I'm going to even underline the thing you just said right there. The ability to change your mind requires forgetting. I've been asked a billion times. I go to Trump rallies and people ask, "Have you ever changed anybody's mind? Do you change people's minds? Do their minds get changed? And sadly, I see very few examples of it. Is that one of the key elements that I'm missing, that we are losing? We're trying to change people's minds through more information as opposed to bonking them over the head, hoping that they lose some sort of memory, and then giving them new information? Is that what I should be doing?
I would like to say that, as you know, that seems a little bit wrong to me. I think what the governor has dedicated his life doing.
Courageous stand there, doctor.
MDMA. Jeez. How about MDMA? Maybe if we do MDMA with these folks, we could get to a better place.
You know, the echo chamber problem. We know it. It's called, in the fancy word, Jordan, you might know, maybe you, governor, is epistemology. How are we sure of what we know?
And
how
that's philosophy, yeah. Epistemology.
Yeah. Which is a word that no one likes, but it means something. It's the echo chamber. And what I found in trying to change a Trumpster's mind is not go into policy, talk about the person, because that's the problem in my mind. And that's occasionally I've won that debate. It's hard, but you know, it's not going to be on piling on more statistics and numbers and this and that on policy. It's really on the meta issue of a personality in my mind.
Doctor, is it just two, maybe I'll get towards the end of this, two last questions. One is it possible that the brain can get too crowded? Number one, you know, when you're really, really busy, you got a million things going on. And your wife says, why didn't you stop and do what I told you? And you say, well, because my brain was, you know, it was too much stuff in my brain. Number one. And number two, is there also an ability for an individual to keep your brain active? In other words, you know, as you age, is it possible to, you know, these, whether it's puzzles or whether it's reading or so, those two things, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, so the first thing is actually pretty straightforward. So absolutely. The reason we sleep, remember we talked about this theory of sleep, 8 hours a day, 7, 6 for some people, everyone does it. Humans do it, birds do it, flies do it. Why do we need to sleep? And one of the most compelling reasons is because we need to sleep in order to forget the clutter. The extraneous information, our brains are sticky with the ability to remember too much stuff. This comes back to social media. And what sleeping does is it engages in active forgetting, the mechanisms we talked about at the get-go. And it's interesting, John, these studies have been performed in soldiers sometimes. What happens when someone is sleep deprived? They don't become, they don't lose their memory. They lose their forgetting. They become psychotic with an overflow of information. So that's, I think, pretty straightforward. On, I'm sorry, the second question, John.
Is there, you know, the keeping the brain active, even, you know, as you go through life, is there ways in which to, it's like a muscle, right? I mean, that's what I'm saying. If you lose your muscle, you atrophy, you get old, you can't walk up and down stairs like you used to. So, you know, the premature efforts to try to keep the brain really active in that part of the brain that you need to activate in order to fend off some of these diseases.
Absolutely. There's something called resilience, actually run a lot by a colleague of mine, Jakob Stern. This idea that, you know, the spare tire idea. As we age, we might all sustain some hits, but if we have more tires, if we'll be more resilient in the face of that. Now the question is how to bottle that. How do I live my life to make sure that my brain is resilient in the eventuality of a disease? There, it's not perfectly clear, but things that are clear are staying cognitively engaged. Education matters. Socializing matters. Preventing cardiovascular risk factors like diabetes and heart disease and diabetes matters. So there's starting to be a clear understanding. Exercise matters. So definitely engage the brain, maintain its health as much as possible. That will clearly reduce the odds of one suffering from the eventuality of having a neurodegenerative disease.
Our great Surgeon General has been focused on something. In fact, Jordan, I think we're might have him out here in Columbus for a visit to our mental health operation. And he focuses a lot on loneliness. That's sort of consistent with what you were saying about socializing. So loneliness is a major problem in this country, isn't it? And nobody wants to admit that they're lonely. I asked somebody the other day, you know, he was divorced, doesn't have any kids. And I asked him, I said, are you lonely? And it was like, I mean, he couldn't believe I asked him the question. Well, I don't know. I don't think I'm lonely. Well, you know, that's a big issue, isn't it, in our society today?
Absolutely. And it was an issue that by necessity was worsened during COVID, the social isolation. And it is a dominant issue. If I have a patient who presents and is depressed, the first thing I ask is about loneliness. Remember, my patients are a little bit older. One of the the issues of people living longer, that those who make it into their 90s are lonely because their other friends and family haven't been so successful. It is a real problem. So I encourage you to focus on this in future podcasts. Absolutely.
In talking about the benefits of forgetting, I'm wondering at what point does forgetting become a problem? Like when should people be concerned?
Right. And this gets back to something maybe I'd like to end on emphasizing. This book is not, God forbid, one of those books that poeticizes pathology. I have a disease and there's a silver lining. I don't believe that, and it's not my temperament. This book is about a clear distinction between pathological forgetting and normal forgetting. Pathological forgetting, as a rule of thumb, can be defined as a worsening of your own baseline. If you're a 40, 50, 60, 70-year-old, and you notice that your memory is worse, that's not normal forgetting. Normal forgetting is what you were born with and what you experienced in your teens and 20s and 30s. And so if you have pathological forgetting, the first recommendation is to consider seeing a doctor to make sure that you get the diagnosis right.
Right. Well, Scott's book, Forgetting the Benefits of Not Remembering, is available now wherever you get your books. Scott, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks, guys. I really enjoyed it.
Hey, everybody. Jordan here, your favorite host of the Kasich Klepper podcast. Thank you for listening this far. If you like what you hear, click like or thumbs up or whatever icon signifies a positive reaction. We love your ratings. We love your thoughts. Reach out to us on social media. Let us know what you want us to talk about, because I'm tired of answering the governor's questions and I just prefer to answer yours. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon. Kasich and Klepper is a production of Treefort Media, hosted and executive produced by John Kasich and Jordan Klepper. Treefort Media's executive producers are Kelly Garner, Lisa Ammerman, and Matthew Kugler. Line producer is Oscar Guido. Associate producer, Lee Albanese. Audio direction by Tom Monahan, head of audio for Treefort, with production and editing by Maxwell Carney. Sound editing by Abigail Sullivan. Talent booking by Blythe Asher. With additional production help from Tim Schauer, Haley Mandelberg, Lindsay Whistler, Colin Motel, and Anastasia Ibrahim. This podcast is powered by Acast.